tray. I put the trays in the oven and turned the heat on, very low. I went out the front and pulled the splintered door as far shut as it would go, ran past the Bentley, and got into the Kleiner Foundation truck, fiddled with the unfamiliar key and started it up, reversed carefully down the driveway and swung backward out onto Beckman Drive, rolled down the slope to town. The windshield wipers beat furiously against the rain. I skirted the big square with the church, made the right turn at the bottom and headed south. The place was deserted. Nobody else on the road. 300 yards south of the village green, I turned into Morrison's driveway, drove the truck up to the house, and parked it next to his abandoned Lincoln, locked the door, ran over to Morrison's boundary fence, and hurled the keys far into the field beyond, shrugged my jacket tight around me and started walking back through the rain, started thinking hard. Saturday was already more than an hour old. Therefore, Sunday was less than a day away. The shape of the thing was clear. I had three facts, for sure. Fact one, Kleiner needed special paper. Fact two, it wasn't obtainable in the States. But fact three, the warehouse was jammed with something. And the writing on those air conditioner boxes was bothering me. Not the Island air conditioning ink, not the printed bit, the other writing, the serial numbers. The boxes I'd seen had handwritten serial numbers in printed rectangles. I had seen them quite clearly. The Jacksonville cops had described the same thing on the box's installer's speeding truck. Long, handwritten serial numbers. But why? The boxes themselves were good cover, good camouflage. Hauling something secret to Florida and beyond in air conditioner boxes was a smart move. No product was more plausible for the markets down there. The boxes had fooled the Jacksonville cops. They hadn't thought twice about it. But the serial numbers bothered me. If there were no electrical appliances in the boxes, why write serial numbers on them? That was taking camouflage to absurd lengths. So what the hell did the serial numbers mean? What the hell had been in those damn boxes? That was the question I was asking myself. In the end, it was Joe who answered it for me. I was walking along in the rain, thinking about what Kelstein had said about precision. He had said Joe had a very attractive precision in the manner in which he expressed himself. I knew that. I was thinking about the neat little list he had printed out for himself. The proud capital letters, the rows of initials, the column of telephone numbers, the two notes at the bottom, Stoller's Garage, Gray's Kleiner File. I needed to check the list again, but I was suddenly sure Joe was telling me if I wanted to know what Kleiner had been putting into those boxes, it might be worth going up to the Stoller's Garage and taking a look. 27. First thing I did back at the house was root around in Charlie Hubble's expensive kitchen for coffee. Started the machine burbling away. Then I opened up the oven, got all my things out. They had been warmed for the best part of an hour, and they were bone dry. The leather on the sap and the keyring had stiffened up some. Other than that, no damage. I put the gun back together and loaded it, left it on the kitchen table, cocked and locked. Then I checked Joe's computer printout for the confirmation I thought was there. But there was a problem, a major problem. The paper was bone dry and crisp, but the writing had gone. The paper was completely blank. The swimming pool water had washed all the ink off. They were very faint, blurred smudges, but I couldn't make out the words. I shrugged to myself. I had read it through 100 times. I'd rely on my memory of what it had said. Next stop was the basement. I fiddled around with the furnace until it kicked in. Then I stripped off and shoved all my clothes in Charlie's electric dryer. Set it on low for an hour. I had no idea what I was doing. In the army, some corporal had done my laundry. Took it away, brought it back clean and folded. Since then, I always bought cheap stuff and just junked it. I walked upstairs naked and went into Hubble's bathroom. Took a long, hot shower and scrubbed the mascara off my face. Stood for a long time in the hot water. Wrapped myself up in a towel and went down for the coffee. I couldn't go up to Atlanta that night. I couldn't get there before maybe 3:30 in the morning. That was the wrong time to be sure of talking my way inside. I had no ID to show, and no proper status. A night visit could turn into a problem. I would have to leave it until tomorrow, first thing. No choice. So I thought about sleeping. I turned the kitchen radio off and wandered through to Hubble's den, turned the television off, looked around. It was a dark, snug room, lots of wood paneling and big leather chairs. Next to the television was a stereo, some kind of a Japanese thing, rows of compact discs and cassette tapes, big emphasis on the Beatles. Hubble had said he'd been interested in John Lennon. He'd been to the Dakota in New York City and to Liverpool in England. He had just about everything. All the albums, a few bootlegs, that singles collection on CD they sold in a wooden box. Over the desk was a bookshelf, stacks of professional periodicals, and a row of heavy books. Technical banking journals and reports. The professional periodicals took up a couple of feet of shelf space. They looked pretty deadly. Random copies of something calling itself the Banking Journal. A couple of issues of a solid magazine called Bank Management. One called Banker. Banker's Magazine. Banker's Monthly. Business Journal. Business Week. Cash Management Bulletin. The Economist, the Financial Post, all filed in line with the alphabet, all in neat date order. Just random copies ranging back over the last few years, no complete sets. At the end of the row were some U.S. Treasury Department dispatches and a couple of issues of something calling itself World of Banking. A curious collection. Seemed very selective. Maybe they were especially heavy issues. Maybe Hubble had read them through when he couldn't sleep. I wasn't going to have any trouble sleeping. I was on my way out of the den, off to find a bed to borrow, when something occurred to me. I stepped back to the desk and peered at the bookshelf again. Ran my finger along the row of magazines and journals, checked the dates printed on the spines, under the pompous titles. Some of them were recent issues. The random sequence continued right up to the latest issue of a couple of them. More than a dozen were from this year. Fully a third of them were published after Hubble had left his job at the bank, after he had been let go. They were published for bankers, but by then Hubble hadn't been a banker anymore. But he had still been ordering up these heavy, professional journals. He had still been getting them. Still reading all this complicated stuff. Why? I pulled out a couple of the periodicals, looked at the covers. They were thick, glossy magazines. I held them in my fingers at the top and bottom of the spines. They fell open at the pages Hubble had consulted. I looked at those pages. Pulled out some more issues, let them fall open. I sat down in Hubble's leather chair. I sat there, wrapped in his towel, reading. I read right through the shelf, from left to right, from beginning to end, all the periodicals. It took me an hour. Then I started in on the books. I ran my finger along the dusty row, stopped with a little shock when I spotted a couple of names I knew, Gelstein and Bartholomew. A big old volume, bound in red leather, their Senate subcommittee report. I pulled it out and started flicking through. It was an amazing publication. Gelstein had modestly described it as the anti-counterfeiter's Bible. And it was. He had been too modest. It was totally exhaustive. It was a painstaking history of every known forging technique. Copious examples and instances were taken from every racket ever discovered. I hefted the heavy volume onto my lap, read for another solid hour. At first I concentrated on paper problems. Gelstein had said that paper was the key. He and Bartholomew had provided a long appendix about paper. It expanded on what he had told me face to face. The cotton and linen fibers, the chemical colorant, the introduction of the red and blue polymer threads. The paper was produced in Dalton, Massachusetts, by an outfit called Crane and Company. I nodded to myself. I had heard of them. Seemed to me I had bought some Christmas cards made by them. I remembered the thick, heavy card and the creamy rag envelopes. I had liked them. The company had been making currency stock for the Treasury since 1879. For over a century, it had been trucked down to Washington under heavy guard in armored cars. None had ever been stolen. Not a single sheet. Then I flipped backward from the appendix and started looking at the main text. I piled Hubble's little library on his desk, trawled through it all again, some things I read twice, three times. I kept diving back into the untidy sprawl of dense articles and reports, checking, cross-referencing, trying to understand the arcane language. I kept going back to the big red Senate report. There were three paragraphs I read over and over again. The first was about an old counterfeiting ring in Bogota, Colombia. The second was about a much earlier Lebanese operation. The Christian phalangists had teamed up with some Armenian engravers during an old civil war. The third was some basic stuff about chemistry. Lots of complicated formulas, but there were a few words I recognized. I read the three paragraphs time and time again. I wandered through to the kitchen, picked up Joe's blank list, stared at it for a long time, wandered back to the dark, quiet den, and sat in a pool of light and thought and read. Halfway through the night. It didn't put me to sleep. It had exactly the opposite effect. It woke me up. It gave me a hell of a buzz. It left me shaking with shock and excitement, because by the time I had finished, I knew exactly how they were getting their paper. I knew exactly where they were getting it from. I knew what had been in those air conditioner boxes last year. I didn't need to go up to Atlanta and look. I knew. I knew what Kleiner was stockpiling at his warehouse. I knew what all those trucks were bringing in every day. I knew what Joe's heading had meant. E unum pluribus. I knew why he had chosen that reversed motto. I knew everything. With 24 hours still to go, the whole thing, from beginning to end, from top to bottom, from the inside out. And it was one hell of a clever operation. Old Professor Gelstein had said the paper was unobtainable, but Kleiner had proved him wrong. Kleiner had found a way of obtaining it, a very simple way. I jumped up from the desk and ran down to the basement, wrenched open the dryer door and pulled my clothes out, dressed, hopping from foot to foot on the concrete floor. Left the towel where it fell, ran back up to the kitchen, loaded up my jacket with the things I was going to need, ran outside, leaving the splintered doors swinging, ran over the gravel to the Bentley, started it up, and threaded it backward down the drive, roared off down Beckman, and squealed a left onto Main Street, gunned it through the silent town and out beyond the diner, howled another left onto the Warburton Road, and pushed the stately old car along as fast as I dared. The Bentley's headlights were dim, 20-year-old design. The night was patchy. Dawn was hours away, and the last of the trailing storm clouds were scudding across the moon. The road was never quite straight. The camber was off, and the surface was lumpy and slick with storm water. The old car was sliding and wallowing, so I cut the speed back to a cruise. Figured it was smarter to take an extra 10 minutes than to go plowing off into a field. I didn't want to join Joe. I didn't want to be another Reacher brother who knew but who was dead. I passed the copse of trees. It was just a darker patch against the dark sky. Miles away, I could see the perimeter lights of the prison. They were blazing out over the night landscape. I cruised past. Then, for miles, I could see their glow in the mirror behind me. Then I was over the bridge, through Franklin, out of Georgia, into Alabama. I rushed past the old roadhouse Roscoe and I had been in, the pond. It was closed up and dark. Another mile, I was at the motel. I left the motor running and ducked into the office to rouse the night guy. "You got a guest called Finley here?" I asked him. He rubbed his eyes and looked at the register. "Yeah. 11, he said. The whole place had that night look on it, slowed down and silent and asleep. I found Finley's cabin, number 11. His police Chevy was parked up outside. I made a lot of noise banging on his door. Had to keep banging for a while. Then I heard an irritated groan. Couldn't make out any words. I banged some more. "Come on, Finley," I called. "Who's there?" I heard him shout. "It's Reacher," I said. "Open the damn door." There was a pause, then the door opened. Finley was standing there. I had woken him up. He was wearing a gray sweatshirt and boxer shorts. I was amazed. I realized I had expected him to be sleeping in his tweed suit with the moleskin vest. "What the hell do you want?" he said. "Something to show you," I told him. He stood, yawning and blinking. "What the hell time is it?" he said. "I don't know," I said. 5 o'clock, 6 maybe. "Get dressed. We're going somewhere." "Going where?" he said. "Atlanta," I said. "Something to show you." "What something?" he said. "Just tell me, can't you?" "Get dressed, Finley," I said again. "Gotta go." He grunted, but he went to get dressed. Took him a while. 15 minutes, maybe. He disappeared into the bathroom. Went in there looking like a normal sort of a guy, just woken up. Came out looking like Finley, tweed suit and all. "Okay," he said. "This better be damn good, Reacher." We went out into the night. I walked over to the car while he locked his cabin door. Then he joined me. "You driving?" he said. "Why?" I said. "You got a problem with that?" He looked irritable as hell, glared at the gleaming Bentley. "Don't like people driving me," he said. "You want to let me drive?" "I don't care who drives," I said. "Just get in the damn car, will you?" He got in the driver's side, and I handed him the keys. I was happy enough to do that. I was very tired. He started the Bentley up and backed it out of the lot, swung east, settled in for the drive. He went fast, faster than I had. He was a hell of a good driver.
"So, what's going on?"
he said to me. I looked across at him. I could see his eyes and the glow from the dash.
"I figured it out," I said. "I know what it's all about."
He glanced back again.
"So, are you going to tell me?"
he said.
"Did you call Princeton?"
I asked him. He grunted and slapped the Bentley's wheel in irritation.
"I was on the phone for an hour," he said. "The guy knew a hell of a lot, but in the end he knew nothing at all."
"What did he tell you?" I asked him.
"He gave me the whole thing," he said. "He was a smart guy. History post-grad working for Bartholomew. Turns out Bartholomew and the other guy, Kelstein, were the big noises in counterfeiting research. Joe had been using them for background."
I nodded across at him. "I got all that from Kelstein," I said. He glanced over again, still irritable.
"So why are you asking me about it?" he said.
"I want your conclusions," I told him. "I want to see where you got to."
"We didn't get to anywhere," he said. "They all talked for a year and decided there was no way Kleiner could be getting so much good paper."
"That's exactly what Kelstein said," I told him. "But I figured it out." He glanced over at me again, surprise on his face. In the far distance, I could see the glow of the prison lights at Warburton.
"So tell me about it," he said.
"Wake up and figure it out for yourself, Harvard guy," I said. He grunted again. Still irritable. We drove on. We hurtled into the pool of light spilling from the prison fence, passed by the prison approach. Then the fierce yellow glare was behind us.
"So start me off with a clue, will you?" he said.
"I'll give you two clues," I said. "The heading Joe used on his list, E Unum Pluribus, and then think about what's unique about American currency." He nodded, thought about it, drummed his long fingers on the wheel.
"E Unum Pluribus," he said. "It's a reversal of the U.S. motto, so we can assume it means out of one comes many. Right?"
"Correct," I said. "And what's unique about American banknotes compared to any other country in the world?" He thought about it. He was thinking about something so familiar he wasn't spotting it. We drove on, shot past the stand of trees on the left. Up ahead, a faint glimmer of dawn in the east.
"What?" he said.
"I've lived all over the world," I said. "Six continents, if you count a brief spell in an Air Force weather hut in Antarctica. Dozens of countries. I've had lots of different sorts of paper money in my pocket. Yen, Deutschmarks, pounds, lira, pesos, wands, francs, shekels, rupees. Now I've got dollars. What have I noticed?"
Finlay shrugged. "What?" he said.
"Dollars are all the same size," I said. "Fifties, hundreds, tens, twenties, fives and ones, all the same size. No other country I've seen does that. Anywhere else, the high-value notes are bigger than the small-value notes. There's a progression, right? Anywhere else, the one is a small bill. The five is bigger, the ten is bigger, and so on. The biggest value bills are usually great big sheets of paper. But American dollars are all the same size. The $100 bill is the same size as the $1 bill.
So?
He asked. So, where are they getting the paper from? I asked him. I waited. He glanced out of his window, away from me. He wasn't getting it, and that was irritating him. They're buying it, I said. They're buying the paper for a buck a sheet. He sighed and gave me a look.
They're not buying it, for God's sake, he said. Bartholomew's guy made that clear. It's manufactured up in Dalton, and the whole operation is as tight as a fish's asshole. They haven't lost a single sheet in 120 years. Nobody's selling it off on the side, Reacher.
Wrong, Finlay, I said. It's for sale in the open market. He grunted again. We drove on. Came to the turn onto the county road. Finlay slowed and swung left, headed north toward the highway. Now the glimmer of dawn was on our right. It was getting stronger. They're scouring the country for $1 bills, I said. That was the role Hubble took over a year and a half ago. That used to be his job at the bank, cash management. He knew how to get hold of cash. So he arranged to obtain $1 bills from banks, malls, retail chains, supermarkets, racetracks, casinos, anywhere he could. It was a big job. They needed a lot of them. They're using bank checks and wire transfers and bogus hundreds, and they're buying in genuine $1 bills from all over the U.S., about a ton a week. Finlay stared across at me, nodded. He was beginning to understand. A ton a week, he said. How many is that? A ton in singles is $1 million, I said. They need 40 tons a year. $40 million in singles. Go on, he said. The trucks bring them down to Margrave, I said. From wherever Hubble sourced them, they come into the warehouse. Finlay nodded. He was catching on. He could see it. Then they got shipped out again in the air conditioner cartons, he said. Correct, I said. Until a year ago. Until the Coast Guard stopped them. Nice, new, fresh boxes, probably ordered from some cardboard box factory 2,000 miles away. They packed them up, sealed them with tape, shipped them out. But they used to count them first, before shipping them. He nodded again. To keep the books straight, he said. But how the hell do you count a ton of dollar bills a week? They weighed them, I said. Every time they filled the box, they stuck it on a scale and weighed it. With singles, an ounce is worth $30. A pound is worth $480. I read about all that last night. They weighed it. They calculated the value. Then they wrote the amount on the side of the box. How do you know? He said. The serial numbers, I said, showed how much money was in the box. Finlay smiled a rueful smile. Okay, he said. Then the boxes went to Jacksonville Beach, right? I nodded. Got put on a boat, I said. Got taken down to Venezuela. Then we fell silent. We were approaching the warehouse complex up at the top of the old county road. It loomed up on our left like the center of our universe. The metal siding reflected the pale dawn. Finlay slowed. We looked over at the place. Our heads swiveled around as we drove past. Then we swung up the ramp onto the highway, headed north for Atlanta. Finlay mashed the pedal, and the stately old car hummed along faster. "What's in Venezuela?" I asked him. He shrugged across at me.
Lots of things, right? He said.
Kleiner's Chemical Works, I said. It relocated there after the EPA problem.
So? He said.
So what does it do? I asked him. What's that chemical plant for?
Something to do with cotton, he said.
Right, I said. Involving sodium hydroxide, sodium hypochlorite, chlorine, and water. What do you get when you mix all those chemicals together? He shrugged. The guy was a cop, not a chemist. Bleach, I said. Bleach. Pretty strong, especially for cotton fiber.
So? He said again.
What did Bartholomew's guy tell you about currency paper? I asked him. Finley inhaled sharply. It was practically a gasp.
Christ, he said. Currency paper is mostly cotton fiber with a bit of linen. They're bleaching the dollar bills. My God, Reacher, they're bleaching the ink off. I don't believe it. They're bleaching the ink off the singles and giving themselves 40 million sheets of genuine blank paper to play with.
I grinned at him and he held out his right hand. We smacked a high five and whooped at each other, alone in the speeding car.
You got it, Harvard guy, I said. That's how they're doing it.
No doubt about that. They've figured out the chemistry and they're reprinting the blank bills as hundreds. That's what Joe meant. He, unum pluribus, out of one comes many, out of $1 comes $100.
Christ, Finley said again.
They're bleaching the ink off. This is something else, Reacher. And you know what this all means? Right now, that warehouse is stuffed full to the ceiling with 40 tons of genuine dollar bills. There's $40 million in there. 40 tons, all piled up, waiting for the Coast Guard to pull back. We've caught them with their pants down, right?
I laughed happily.
Right, I said. Their pants are down around their ankles. Their asses are hanging out in the breeze. That's what they was so worried about. That's why they're panicking.
Finley shook his head, grinned at the windshield.
How the hell did you figure this out? He asked. I didn't answer right away. We drove on. The highway was hoisting us through the gathering sprawl of Atlanta's southern edge. Blocks were filling up. Construction and commerce were busy confirming the Sunbelt's growing strength. Cranes stood ready to shore up the city's southern wall against the rural emptiness outside.
We're going to take this one step at a time, I said. First of all, I'm going to prove it to you. I'm going to show you an air conditioner box stuffed with genuine $1 bills.
You are, he said. Where?
I glanced across at him.
In the Stoller's garage, I said.
Christ's sake, Reacher, he said. It got burned down, and there was nothing in it, right? Even if there was, now it's got the Atlanta PD and fire chiefs swarming all over it.
I've got no information that says it got burned down, I said.
What the hell are you talking about? He said. I told you, it was on the telex.
Where did you go to school? I asked him.
What's that got to do with anything? He said.
Precision, I said. It's a habit of mind. It can get reinforced by good schooling.
You saw Joe's computer printout, right?
Finley nodded.
You recall the second to last item? I asked him.
Stoller's garage, he said.
Right, I said.
But think about the punctuation. If the apostrophe was before the final letter, it would mean the garage belonging to one person called Stoller. The singular possessive, they call it in school, right? But, he said. It wasn't written like that, I said. The apostrophe came after the final letter. It meant the garage belonging to the Stallers, the plural possessive. The garage belonging to two people called Staller. And there weren't two people called Staller living at the house out by the golf course. Judy and Sherman weren't married. The only place we're going to find two people called Staller is the little old house where Sherman's parents live. And they've got a garage. Finley drove on in silence, trawled back to his grade school grammar. You think he stashed the box with his folks? He said. It's logical, I said. The boxes we saw in his own place were empty, but Sherman didn't know he was going to die last Thursday, so it's reasonable to assume he had more savings stashed away somewhere else. He thought he was going to live for years without working. We were just about into Atlanta. The big interchange was coming up. Loop around past the airport, I told him. We skirted the city on a raised ribbon of concrete. We passed near the airport. I found my way back to the poor part of town. It was nearly 7:30 in the morning. The place looked pretty good in the soft morning light. The low sun gave it a spurious glow. I found the right street and the right house, crouching inoffensively behind its hurricane fencing. We got out of the car, and I led Finley through the gate in the wire fence, along the straight path to the door. I nodded to him. He pulled his badge and pounded on the door. We heard the hallway floor creak. We heard bolts and chains snapping and clinking. Then the door opened. Sherman Staller's mother stood there. She looked awake. Didn't look like we had got her out of bed. She didn't speak, just stared out at us. "Morning, Mrs. Staller," I said. "Remember me?"
"You're a police officer," she said.
Finley held his badge out toward her. She nodded.
"Better come in," she said.
We followed her down the hall into the cramped kitchen.
"What can I do for you?"
the old lady asked. "We'd like to see the inside of your garage, ma'am," Finley said. "We have reason to believe your son may have placed some stolen property there." The woman stood silently in her kitchen for a moment. Then she turned and took a key off a nail on the wall, handed it to us without a word, walked off down the narrow hallway and disappeared into another room. Finlay shrugged at me, and we went back out the front door and walked around to the garage. It was a small, tumble-down structure, barely big enough for a single car. Finley used the key on the lock and swung the door open. The garage was empty except for two tall cartons. They were stacked side by side against the end wall, identical to the empty boxes I'd seen at Sherman Staller's new house, Island Air Conditioning, Inc. But these were still sealed with tape. They had long, handwritten serial numbers. I took a good look at them. According to those numbers, there was $100,000 in each box. Finley and I stood there looking at the boxes, just staring at them. Then I walked over and rocked one out from the wall, took out Morrison's knife and popped the blade, pushed the point under the sealing tape and slit the top open, pulled up the flaps on the top, and pushed the box over. It landed with a dusty thump on the concrete floor. An avalanche of paper money poured out. Cash fluttered over the floor. A mass of paper money. Thousands and thousands of dollar bills. A river of singles. Some new, some crumpled, some in thick rolls, some in wide bricks, some loose and fluttering. The carton spilled its contents, and the flood tide of cash reached Finley's polished shoes. He crouched down and plunged his hands into the lake of money. He grabbed two random fistfuls of cash and held them up. The tiny garage was dim, just a small, dirty window pane letting in the pale morning light. Finley stayed down on the floor with his big hands full of dollar bills. We looked at the money, and we looked at each other. "How much was in there?" Finley asked. I kicked the box over to find the handwritten number. More cash spilled out and fluttered over the floor. "Nearly 100,000," I told him. "What about the other one?" he said. I looked over at the other box, read the long, handwritten number. 100 grand plus change," I said. "Must be packed tighter." He shook his head, dropped the dollar bills, and started swishing his hands through the pile. Then he got up and started kicking it around, like a kid does with fall leaves. I joined them. We were laughing and kicking great sprays of cash all over the place. The air was thick with it. We were whooping and slapping each other on the back. We were smacking high tens and dancing around in $100,000 on a garage floor. Finley reversed the Bentley up to the garage door. I kicked the cash into piles and started stuffing it back into the air conditioner box. It wouldn't all go in. Problem was, the tight rolls and bricks had sprung apart. It was just a mess of loose dollar bills. I stood the box upright and crushed the money down as far as I could, but it was hopeless. I must have left about 30 grand on the garage floor. "We'll take the sealed box," Finley said. "Come back for the rest later." "It's a drop in the bucket," I said. "We should leave it for the old folks, like a pension fund, an inheritance from their boy." He thought about it, shrugged, like it didn't matter. The cash was just lying around like litter. There was so much of it, it didn't seem like anything at all. "Okay," he said. We dragged the sealed box out into the morning light, heaved it into the Bentley's trunk. It wasn't easy. The box was very heavy. $100,000 weighs about 200 pounds. We rested up for a moment, panting, then we shut the garage door, left the other 100 grand in there. "I'm going to call Picard," Finley said. He went back into the old couple's house to borrow their phone. I leaned against the Bentley's warm hood and enjoyed the morning sun. 2 minutes, he was back out again. "Gotta go to his office," he said. "Strategy conference." He drove. He threaded his way out of the untidy maze of little streets toward the center, spun the big Bakelite wheel and headed for the towers. "Okay," he said, "you proved it to me. Tell me how you figured it." I squirmed around in the big leather seat to face him. "I wanted to check Joe's list," I said. "That punctuation thing with the Stoller's garage. But the list had gotten soaked in chlorinated water. All the writing had bleached off." He glanced across. "You put it together from that," he said. I shook my head. "I got it from the Senate report," I said. "There were a couple of little paragraphs. One was about an old scam in Bogota. There was another about an operation in Lebanon years ago. They were doing the same thing, bleaching real dollar bills so they could reprint the blank paper." Finley ran a red light, glanced over at me. "So Kleiner's idea isn't original?" he asked. "Not original at all," I said. "But those other guys were very small scale, very low-level stuff. Kleiner built it up to a huge scale, sort of industrial. He's a Henry Ford of counterfeiting. Henry Ford didn't invent the automobile, right? But he invented mass production. He stopped at the next red light. There was traffic on the cross street. The bleaching thing was in the Senate report, he said. So how come Bartholomew or Kelstein didn't get it? They wrote the damn thing, right? I think Bartholomew did get it, I said. I think that's what he finally figured out. That's what the email was about. He had just remembered it. It was a very long report, thousands of pages, written a long time ago. The bleaching thing was just one tiny footnote in a mass of other stuff. And it referred to very small-scale operations. No comparison at all with the volume Kleiner's into. Can't blame Bartholomew or Kelstein. They're old guys. No imagination. Finley shrugged, parked up next to a hydrant in a tow zone. 28. Picard met us in his Dua lobby and took us off into a side room. We ran through what we knew. He nodded, and his eyes gleamed. He was looking at a big case.
Excellent work, my friends, he said. But who are we dealing with now? I think we got to say all these little Hispanic guys are outsiders. They're the hired help. They're not concealed. But locally, we still got 5 out of the original 10 hidden away. We haven't identified them. That could make things very tricky for us. We know about Morrison, Teal, Baker, and the 2 Kleiners, right? But who are the other 5? Could be anybody down there, right?
I shook my head at him. We only need to ID 1 more, I said. I sniffed out 4 more last night. There's only the 10th guy we don't know. Picard and Finley both sat up.
Who are they? Picard said.
The 2 gatemen from the warehouse, I said, and 2 more cops, the backup crew from last Friday.
More cops, Finley said. Shit.
Picard nodded, laid his giant hands palm down on the table.
Okay, he said. You guys head back to Margrave right now. Try to stay out of trouble, but if you can't, then make the arrests. But be very careful of this 10th guy. Could be anybody at all. I'll be right behind you. Give me 20 minutes to go get Roscoe back, and I'll see you down there.
We all stood up, shook hands all round. Picard headed upstairs, and Finley and I headed back out to the Bentley.
How? He asked me.
Baker, I said. He bumped into me last night. I spun him a yarn about going up to Hubble's place, looking for some documentation. Then I went up there and waited to see what would happen. Along came the Kleiner kid and 4 of his pals. They came to nail me to Hubble's bedroom wall.
Christ, he said. So, what happened?
I took them out, I said. He did his thing of staring sideways at me at 90 miles an hour.
You took them out, he said. You took the Kleiner kid out.
I nodded. He was quiet for a while, slow to 85.
How did it go down? He asked.
I ambushed them, I said. 3 of them I hit on the head. 1 of them I cut his throat. The Kleiner kid I drowned in the swimming pool. That's how Joe's list got soaked, washed all the writing off.
Christ, he said again. You killed 5 men. That's a hell of a thing, Reacher. How do you feel about that?
I shrugged. Thought about my brother Joe. Thought about him as a tall, gawky 18-year-old just off to West Point. Thought about Molly Beth Gordon holding up her heavy burgundy leather briefcase, smiling at me. I glanced across at Finley and answered his question with one of my own. How do you feel when you put roach powder down? I asked him. He shook his head in a spasm, like a dog clearing its coat of cold water.
Only four left, he said.
He started kneading the old car's steering wheel like he was a baker making a pastry twist. He looked through the windshield and blew a huge sigh.
Any feeling for this tenth guy? He said.
Doesn't really matter who it is, I said. Right now, he's up at the warehouse with the other three. They're short of staff now, right? They'll all be on guard duty overnight, loading duty tomorrow. All four of them. I flicked on the Bentley's radio. Some big chrome thing. Some kind of a 20-year-old English make. But it worked. It pulled in a decent station. I sat listening to the music, trying not to fall asleep.
Unbelievable, Finley said.
How the hell did a place like Margrave's start up with a thing like this?
How did it start? I said.
It started with Eisenhower. It's his fault.
Eisenhower, he said. What's he got to do with it?
He built the interstates, I said. He killed Margrave. Way back, that old county road was the only road. Everybody and everything had to pass through Margrave. The place was full of rooming houses and bars. People were passing through, spending money. Then the highways got built, and air travel got cheap, and suddenly the town died. It withered away to a dot on the map because the highway missed it by 14 miles.
So it's the highway's fault, he said.
It's Mayor Teal's fault, I said. The town sold the land for the warehouses to earn itself some new money, right? Old Teal brokered the deal. But he didn't have the courage to say no when the new money turned out to be bad money. Kleiner was fixing to use it for the scam he was setting up, and old Teal jumped straight into bed with him.
He's a politician, Finley said. They never say no to money. And it was a hell of a lot of money.
Teal rebuilt the whole town with it.
He drowned the whole town with it, I said.
The place is a cesspool. They're all floating around in it, from the mayor right down to the guy who polishes the cherry trees. We stopped talking again. I fiddled with the radio dial and heard Albert King tell me if it wasn't for bad luck, he wouldn't have no luck at all.
But why Margrave? Finley said again.
Old Albert told me bad luck and trouble's been his only friend.
Geography and opportunity, I said.
It's in the right place. All kinds of highways meet down here, and it's a straight run on down to the boatyards in Florida. It's a quiet place, and the people who ran the town were greedy scumbags who'd do what they were told. He went quiet, thinking about the torrent of dollar bills rushing south and east, like a storm drain after a flood, a little tidal wave, a small and harassed workforce in Margrave keeping it rolling on. The slightest hitch, and tens of thousands of dollars would back up and jam, like a sewer. Enough money to drown a whole town in. He drummed his long fingers on the wheel, drove the rest of the way in silence. We parked up in the slot nearest the station house door. The car was reflected in the plate glass, an antique black Bentley, worth $100,000 on its own, with another $100,000 in the trunk, the most valuable vehicle in the state of Georgia. I popped the trunk lid, laid my jacket on top of the air conditioner box, waited for Finley, and walked up to the door. The place was deserted, apart from the desk sergeant. He nodded to us. We skirted the reception counter, walked through the big, quiet squad room to the Rosewood office and back, stepped in and closed the door. Finley looked uneasy. I want to know who the 10th guy is, he said. It could be anybody. Could be the desk sergeant. There's been 4 cops in this already. It's not him, I said. He never does anything. Just parks his fat ass on that stool. Could be Stevenson, though. He was connected to Hubble. He shook his head. No, he said. Teal pulled him in off the road when he took over. He wanted him where he could see him. So it's not Stevenson. I guess it could be anybody. Could be Eno, up at the diner. He's a bad-tempered type of a guy. I looked at him. You're a bad-tempered type of a guy, Finley, I said. Bad temper never made anybody a criminal. He shrugged, ignored the jibe. So, what do we do? He said. We wait for Roscoe and Picard, I said. We take it from there. I sat on the edge of the big rosewood desk, swinging my leg. Finley paced up and down on the expensive carpet. We waited like that for about 20 minutes, and then the door opened. Picard stood there. He was so big he filled the whole doorway. I saw Finley staring at him like there was something wrong with him. I followed his gaze. There were 2 things wrong with Picard. First, he didn't have Roscoe with him. Second, he was holding a government issue 38 in his giant hand. He was holding it rock steady, and he was pointing it straight at Finley. 29.
You?
Finley gasped. Picard smiled a cold smile at him. None other, he said. The pleasure's all mine, believe me. You've been very helpful, both of you. Very considerate. You've kept me in touch every step of the way. You've given me the Hubbles, and you've given me Officer Roscoe. I really couldn't have asked for anything more. Finley was rooted to the spot, shaking.
You,
he said again.
Should have spotted it Wednesday, asshole, Picard said. I sent the little guy to Joe's hotel 2 hours before I told you about it. You disappointed me. I expected to be doing this scene way before now.
He looked at us and smiled. Finley turned away, looked at me. I couldn't think of anything to say to him. I couldn't think about anything at all. I just looked at Picard's huge bulk in the doorway and had a strong feeling that this was going to be the last day of my life. Today it would end. Get over there, Picard said to me, next to Finley. He had taken 2 giant strides into the room, and he was pointing the gun straight at me. I noticed mechanically that it was a new 38 with a short barrel. I calculated automatically that it would be accurate over such a short distance, but that a 38 couldn't be relied on to put a target down. And there were 2 of us, and 1 of him. And Finley had a weapon in a shoulder holster under the tweed jacket. I spent a fraction of a second weighing up the odds. Then I abandoned the calculation because Mayor Teal stepped through the open door behind Picard. He had his heavy cane in his left hand, but in his right hand he was carrying a police-issue shotgun. It was an Ithaca Mag 10. Didn't really matter where he was pointing it. Get over there, Picard said to me again. Where's Roscoe? I said to him. He laughed at me. Just laughed, and gestured with the gun barrel that I should stand up and move over next to Finley. I heaved myself off the desk and stepped over. I felt like I was weighted down with lead. I clamped my lips and moved with the grim determination of a cripple trying to walk. I stood next to Finley. Teal covered us with the giant scattergun. Picard darted his hand up under Finley's jacket, took the revolver out of his holster, slipped it into the pocket of his own enormous